Podcast family, before we begin, a quick disclosure. This episode deals with perinatal PTSD. It's a tough discussion. It's tough info. But the way that we win over this difficult beast is by identifying it and tackling it head on. This is not meant to be triggering for anybody, but this has been in our press a lot in the last 3 months. And so we're going to talk about this in this episode. Also, the disclosure is I'm going to read an excerpt from an email I received from a listener in Ireland. It's de-identified, and I just wanted to disclose that I do have a written authorization, written permission to share this story for educational purposes. Traumatic events can be objective, like nearly losing your life in an accident, being the victim of some horrendous crime, or even witnessing some horrible atrocity against someone else. But trauma can also be subjective, because we never know what somebody is going through on the inside, and when some otherwise seemingly quote-unquote mild occurrence happens, that may trigger them over the edge, when somebody on the outside may say, what? It's just postpartum hemorrhage. I mean, you didn't get any blood transfusion, you didn't go to the ICU, you did fine. We should never minimize somebody's potential interpretation of something as traumatic. There has been a lot of brand new data out surrounding the reality of childbirth or perinatal PTSD, and it's eye-opening. There's brand new data out, even showing sometimes how maybe potentially down the road with more data, service dogs may help with this occurrence. I'm going to explain that in a moment. But I found this wonderful, beautiful quote from a very unassuming person. And this person is not a healthcare provider, is not a psychologist per se. It's actually a children's television host. Yeah, I'm talking about Mr. Rogers, like Fred Rogers. Fred Rogers, very unassuming, seemed to be just overall benign individual. But his little lessons that he gave were honestly very deep, profound, and valid. Well, his quote that I'm about to share with you here is absolutely relevant for our discussion of perinatal PTSD and new developments that are on the horizon. We're going to talk about it in this episode, and I want to make it very real for all of us. Even though we're going to talk about data, we're going to talk about new publications, I want to share with you, with de-identified means, okay, no one's going to give out any names here, an email that I received from Ireland from somebody who's, as far as I can gather, not a healthcare worker, but reached out after finding a topic on our podcast channel about subgaleal hemorrhage. Her daughter had a subgaleal hemorrhage, and it was a very traumatic issue. I just want to share with you one excerpt from this email without giving away any, you know, patient characteristics, and how traumatic this event and surrounding events were for this one individual. Thankfully, the child is now 19 months old. Seems to be progressing well, but as this person wrote, I can't wait for her to start talking so she can tell me how she's feeling, because I just don't know. And this whole process was objectively, not just subjectively, but objectively terrifying and horrible. And we're going to discuss that in a minute, okay? And yes, you know, we covered subgaleal hemorrhages, and yes, they can happen naturally. But the highest risk, the highest association is with a vacuum-assisted delivery. This child did have a vacuum-assisted delivery. And so this person just reached out just saying, does this happen? What? Tell me more about this. Just looking for information. And the reason she did that is exactly what Fred Rogers said in his quote. It's amazing. I'm going to share this with you. And I want us all to realize that things that we take for granted all the time as healthcare workers, whether you're a midwife, physician, PA, MP, whatever, that we have some, you know, malocclusions like, it's just a vacuum, you know, get over it, right? Everything went fine. That could be traumatic. Oh my gosh, you pushed for 4 hours and then you got a C-section? Hey, it happens. It's not a big deal. We're just going to do a section. That could be traumatic. And it's not just the patient. The family members around are also in the same capability of developing perinatal PTSD. not to mention the whole second victim issue, which has to do with the healthcare team, especially in an objectively traumatic issue like a perinatal cardiac arrest, perinatal exsanguination, perinatal deaths. And again, I've shared with this before. My first perinatal death was with a undiagnosed Procrita, and I was done. I'm just not doing that again. It was horrifying. And looking back now, yes, I had flashbacks in my mind. I couldn't sleep at night. I was irritable. I was anxious when a pregnant patient came back in, which is difficult for me because I'm an OBGYN. And so looking back now, that was a PTSD, and thankfully I was able to work through that. But it never leaves you. Trauma leaves imprints that are hard to erase. The good news is that even though they are hard to erase, they can be erased, but it takes work. We're going to talk about data that just came out at the end of March 2024, another publication very related to that, which came out at the end of December 2023, just literally 3 to 4 months ago. All of this is very relevant, and I'm going to read that email from this listener, again, who's not even a healthcare provider. She just found me and kind of likes the way that we deliver the information, which I'm very thankful for, as she's working through her traumatic delivery event. Let me read you this quote from Fred Rogers from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, because it is just so simple, yet oddly so profound. Mr. Rogers states, "Anything that's human is mentionable, and anything that is mentionable can be more manageable. When we talk about our feelings, they become less overwhelming, less upsetting, and less scary. The people we trust with that important talk can help us know that we are not alone." Is that profound or what? Historically, medicine was basically, don't ask, don't tell, right? Do you agree with that? It was a bad outcome. Hey, things happen. We're going to keep on going and don't bring it up because it's medical legal. No, that never works. Keeping things in the shadows is a great way for things to spiral out of control. We now know that appropriate explanation, appropriate apology if there is a medical error or a never event, that helps de-escalate and helps make understanding. Look, after all, look, no one's perfect. I mean, medicine is made up of flawed people. I've got many issues and I'm flawed, guys. I just try my best every day. And every day I fail. Let's be honest. I mean, something sets me off. I get angry. I get irritated. If it's not at work, it's with a text message. Or I hate to say that my wife takes the brunt of some of that when it's been a frustrating day. That's not right. And why does that happen? Because we're all flawed. I'm working through it. I am working through it. I'm trying to improve. All to say, we must recognize that when the irony happens, when things spiral downwards, when things go south from something that's supposed to be one of the happiest times in general, right, in general, of a woman and a couple's life, the birth of a child, when something throws that for a loop, it can leave an imprint. So we're going to tackle all of this. We're going to talk about how a service dog can maybe help detect PTSD. That's novel. And we're going to get into all this data. Anyway, that was a long intro, but I just didn't know any other way to do this because it's so impactful. Man, and whether, even if it happens to you and you don't think it's traumatic, like, hey, I had a really stressful day, you know, XYZ happened, but I'm okay. Are you? I mean, it's okay to talk about this. And I'm going to show you some data here that's been both praised for calling attention to perinatal PTSD, and has also been thrown under the bus like, wait, those numbers aren't right. And I'm going to explain all of this coming up. All right, that's enough of the intro. Let that settle. Take a breath, and let's get into the data now. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls. Oh man, there's so much to cover, and I want to do this in a brief amount of time. You see how I bumped the previous topic? I told you in the last episode that I was going to do amnioinfusion in the presence of chorioamnionitis. Is that acceptable or not? And I bumped that again. I'm driving my team crazy. But I promise at some point I'm going to tackle that. But ever since I got this email from this listener in Ireland, I've just been thinking about this occurrence, what this patient is going through. And I'm like, I've got to put something out. One is in a way to try to honor her and her story. And also because this has been in our print a lot just recently in the last couple of days. And I'll share all that with you. But this is something that I don't think gets addressed enough. And now we've got a great blueprint from a very nice publication that says, hey, if we're open and tackle this thing early, like while the patient is still admitted, after an objectively traumatic event or subjective, like operative assisted vaginal delivery. Even if the baby's doing fine, there's no issues, no subgaleal bleed, there's no fourth degree lack, especially if there's a fourth degree lack, this should happen. But there's data that addressing it at that point, just with a quick bedside evaluation and question, like how, this is a tough one, guys, listen to this very deep algorithm. Ask, how are you doing? I mean, I know that sounds basic, and it is. The idea of not just, hey, have you gone to the restroom? Are you peeing? Is there any fevers? Do your breast hurt? How, you know, do you feel dizzy? That's all the medical stuff. But really just say, hey, I want to go over with you what happened. Do you understand why we did this? Do you understand the indication? Do you have any questions? Let's talk about this. That validation, talking about what happened openly, can do wonders at prevention so it doesn't linger. The fear of the unknown and not knowing triggers trauma. I mean, it's amazing. Guys, I've been there many times. Look, man, I've told you, I'm sure we all have stuff in our lives. Some people more than once. And I've been there. And it's caused me from stuff from childhood to still linger with things today. Right? And you all know the story. We're not getting into that. But I'm still suffering from that stuff and how things affect current relationships. You've got to talk about this or else it becomes very difficult to undo the wrapping and find the gift at the core. Okay, it can be done, but there's a lot of layers of wrapping in that case. If you can do it before it gets wrapped and attack it at the heart of the issue, that's what the data show is best. Okay. Now, just talking about traumatic issues, just very quickly, do something, whether it's a brief discussion. And I know what you're all saying. Look, I'm not a cognitive behavioral therapist. I'm not a psychologist. I got things to do. Yeah, we all have things to do. I'm busy too. I'm getting pulled in a thousand directions. All right, maybe not a thousand. Being pulled in lots of directions, especially during rounds. I got things to do, especially if I've got a surgery that we're waiting for. I get that. But what if it was your spouse, you, daughter, whatever? Give them that 5 minutes. Is 5 minutes really going to throw us off of our day? I don't think so. So just keep that in mind, because that brief discussion with a patient, that validation that I know something happened, we got to talk about it. And if not then, at least open up the door and then make a plan to come back. I'm very thankful that our group with our university, our practice group is multidisciplinary, from sports medicine to family medicine, OBGYN, and behavioral health. And nutrition. But behavioral health is a huge benefit. So the first is that acknowledgement and validation that, yes, something happened, and ideally at time of the admission, okay? Remember, that's not just for objectively bad things, but for subjectively bad things as well. Things that may not have been expected, but that occurred, all right? Just bring it up and say, do you have any questions? Can we talk about this? How are you doing? Do you want to talk about this later? We can refer you to somebody else or give you another appointment to come back with us. Just don't ignore it as a take-home message. Now, even though we're not psychologists by training, that understanding and opening the door now has proven data that helps. Okay, I'll give you that data here in a minute. And just even though we just do that as a door opener, sending the patient to formal treatment like cognitive behavioral therapy or EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, we know that that works for trauma. Big time. There's data now for EMDR for OCD. It's amazing. And in all disclosure, my wife is an EMDR therapist, all right? And it's stuff that you're like, wait, what? The eyes do what? That's not a thing. Oh, it's a thing. It's a big thing. And what started out as a novel kind of concept, I guess, like 20 years ago or so, is now, hey, this thing works by changing the way that neurons fire and changing the connections in the brain. I am not an EMDR specialist. I know very peripherally about it. I've asked my wife to come on the show to kind of give some info, and she repetitively says I'm not doing that because she's just, that's not her personality. But I'll get her one of these days to do it. So now that we've said all that, let me just read you just a few sentences from this email from this listener from Ireland. I don't know personally, and based on her communications with me in the last couple of days, she says, as a lay person, you know, I listen to your episode, so that implies to me nothing in healthcare, all right? And by the way, she didn't ask to, this is not a medical legal thing, this is not to poke blame at someone. This was literally, the request was, can somebody explain it to me? Now, honestly, that should be her providers doing that, right? But stuff happens, and she felt like there's a roadblock to short of it. And that should never be the case. But let me just read you this quick thing. Short of it is, remember, this patient underwent a vacuum-assisted delivery. Child is now 19 months of age. Child had a moderate subgaleal hemorrhage, okay, based on the dimensions of the head distortion and the need for phototherapy. As we discussed in our episode on subgaleal hemorrhage, which is how she found me, that pretty much qualifies as moderate. Severe need for blood transfusion or some severe neurological sequelae like seizures, obtunded state, encephalopathy, things of that nature, okay? So it sounds like it was, the need for phototherapy really makes it moderate. So let me just read you this quote. Here it is. I found the experience so traumatic. Now, let's just stop there for a minute. Is she over-exaggerating? No. Is she just using these words like, oh, so traumatic? Loosey-goosey? No. So right then and there, in literally, what is that, 7 words or so? It's right there. So my first response back was, hey, we can talk about subgaleal bleed, just peripherally, just very general, because I wasn't there, obviously. And I don't have all of the data. I'm just, if you wanted information, here it is, very general. Okay, that was my role. Just because understanding helps with healing, I just wanted to open that up, okay? And I'm never going to push somebody away who's asking for help. I mean, that's just human decency, I think. But this is what she said. I found the experience so traumatic. So my first response back was, look, let's just stop there for a minute. You got to work that out. My goodness, this was traumatic. It's going to affect future relationships. Please seek somebody who understands how to undo that knot. Okay, the string has a knot in it. Find somebody to unwind that. That was my first response. The listener continues when she wrote in the email, quote, to add to the trauma, listen to this, guys. I mean, when we think, like, it's one thing for one bad thing to occur, right? What have we said in the past? Things come in three. I want you all to see this. How, and again, not new agey at all, but damn, this poor woman. I mean, if you don't feel for this, then that's cold-hearted, man. I mean, let me just look what this patient went through. So when we think, oh, I'm so tired, right? My call was bad. Put it in perspective. It's all about perspective. And I have to remind myself of that as well. Put it in perspective. So had the delivery, child had a subgaleal bleed, phototherapy, right? So that's enough. That's kind of trauma right there. But then she goes on to say, quote, I nearly lost my husband in a very bad car accident when the child was just 7 weeks old. Now, I substituted the child's name for the child because I don't want to give away the name of the child. How did y'all get that? So traumatic birth. Then, quote, I nearly lost my husband in a very bad car accident when blank was just 7 weeks old. Okay. Here's number 3. Plus, I also developed urosepsis shortly after delivery. So there's your three. I mean, that's a lot. Now, this person gets up every day. This person takes care of the child, as with her partner, who has life-changing injuries. Do you see how all of this is the perfect? This is the perfect sine non, without doubt, recipe for perinatal PTSD, because perinatal is the time surrounding delivery, okay? And it can include antepartum stuff as well, okay? So antepartum delivery, and even in perinatal mood disorders, which we now know extends up to 12 years after delivery, this is a big process, right? So just because the delivery went fine, if something goes south 1 day postpartum, still they're at risk for perinatal PTSD. Does that make sense? All I'm trying to say is look at the true severity of this one person's experience. And I think we can all relate that that is a perfect ingredient for perinatal PTSD. On April the 1st, 2024, a new publication that used codeine mining, right? So they had a big database, and then they mined for the code PTSD diagnoses was published. This came out of Health Affairs, again, April the 1st, 2024. And it looked for the occurrence of that code, perinatal post-traumatic stress disorder, among those who had insurance. So it's only those that are commercially insured. So that's one of the limitations, but it spanned a long time, over a decade. It spanned 2008 to 2020. Now, remember, 2019, 2020, we're kind of in that COVID time. So obviously, everybody's stress meter was up, okay? Nonetheless, from 2008 to 2020, what they found got a lot of attention, yet at the same time, a lot of criticism. Okay, so let me explain this. One, it got attention and praise because, great, I'm glad that we're putting, again, more attention to this occurrence, because based in that data mining survey, and one of the limitations, it's just data mining, okay? It's not a prospective study. So if somebody coded something wrong, then that's going to be a factor. But even with that, there's criticisms on the findings, okay? Because even though the number multiplier, the relative risk was absolutely astronomical in its increase for the development of perinatal PTSD from 2008 to 2020, the absolute numbers were way below what is generally accepted as the occurrence of perinatal PTSD. So they're like, dude, you totally underestimated that. But thank you for drawing attention to the issue. Okay, do y'all see that? So they're like, yay, we got more attention for perinatal PTSD. But the numbers are, those can't be right. I'm explaining that in a minute, okay? So, right. So again, this was published in the journal Health Affairs, and it found that the rate of perinatal PTSD diagnoses, again, just data mining, that's all it is, just doing a filter check through a big database and then seeing what puts out through commercial insured patients. They found that the percent increase, okay, the percent increase in perinatal PTSD, here it is, guys, went up 394% in over a decade. And it's not just at the tail end. We're like, oh, that's all COVID. No. It's over that time. Now, yes, COVID played a factor. And yes, we've had increased awareness of this. And so there is an increase. There should be a progressive trend towards more diagnoses of this. What we don't want is that this would be coded incorrectly and people get thrown out PTSD as a diagnosis where it waters down the issue and really hurts those who really need attention. We don't want to do that. Very similar to the old fear of about 20 years ago when all children were getting diagnosed with, you know, ADHD, and they're like, hey, those are just kids. No, it's ADHD. So there was this, that's why there has to be this uniform way of diagnosing perinatal PTSD. So it's diagnosed correctly. And that's one of the problems here. So here's a clinical pearl. So yes, it can be very objective. Hey, you almost died during your delivery. That's traumatic. And it can follow the psychiatric diagnostic criteria based on the DSM-5 criteria, which is very, very black and white. So here it is. Quote, in which childbirth is deemed traumatic if there is a perceived threat to the life of the mother and or infant and or if severe physical injury occurred, end quote. Well, is that it? I mean, does it have to be severe physical injury? And what does severe mean? Is that a fourth degree? Is that a perinatal hysterectomy? I mean, it's very objective. Were you or your child at risk of dying? Well, wait a minute. That's very objective for sure. That fulfills the criteria of a traumatic event. But birth processes can be subjectively traumatic. So I like the much more broad definition of this, which has been published as well. And this is why we can't put people into a box. Hey, well, you didn't die, right? I mean, it wasn't that bad, like that whole meme. But did you die? Wait a minute. You don't have to be close to death for an experience to be traumatic, okay? Because others have defined a traumatic birth experience as, quote, a woman's experience of interactions and or events directly related to childbirth that caused overwhelming, distressing emotions and reactions, leading to short and or long-term negative impacts on the woman's health and well-being. I would add to that, and negatively affect surrounding relationships. So that more broad definition comes from the journal Birth by Lee Weber et al. And the title was Developing a Woman-Centered, Inclusive Definition of Traumatic Childbirth Experiences, a discussion paper, again, 2022. So you see these years that these things are being published, right? This new database query that showed that there's over a 300, almost 400% increase in a decade of this diagnosis, which is good. But the question is, well, that's just a coding issue. So is it rising because we're being too lenient with the diagnosis? I don't think that that's a thing. I think it's being done correctly. And I hope it's not being too stringently applied because, well, you didn't die, so obviously you can't have PTSD. That's my take-home message here, that it does not just have to be severe injury or chance of threat to life of self or child. It's broader than that. So I encourage you to please adopt the journal Birth's description of traumatic event, which is more subjective, that if the patient says, it was traumatic, and we have to be careful, like the way that we use words, right? We do throw words around a lot. So when somebody says, I think, you know, it's very traumatic for me. Wait a minute, are you saying that like it was just, you know, kind of a negative experience, which I understand, or was it really traumatic? It's like saying, oh, I love cupcakes. Well, you really don't love cupcakes. I mean, you really like cupcakes. You see what I mean? We've devalued the word love. Does that make sense? So it's just like, oh, how was your call last night? Oh, it was so traumatic. Was it really? Was it traumatic, or you're just really tired and you were really busy? Were you slightly overwhelmed? Does that make sense? We tend to water down words. So when somebody says that, we need to say, wait a minute, what happened? Let's talk about it. As in the case from Ireland, that was truly traumatic, all right? There were issues there. That is not an overuse of the word. That was a trauma-laden event. So if a patient says trauma, open up the door, take time and go, whoa, 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 that's a hard stop. Let's talk about that. What does that mean to you? And if somebody says, oh, it was just so tired and oh, it just took forever, but, you know, everything was good. Well, don't use traumatic for that. Use the word appropriately. So part of that is, what does that word mean to you? And let's talk about it, because you don't want to use it inappropriately. At the same time, you don't want to minimize somebody's potential traumatic event during childbirth. All right, back to this April 1st, 2024 data mining study from Health Affairs. This is why they were thrown under the bus. So when they were praised, yes, thankfully we have more information, more attention coming to this. Thank you for looking at this for over a decade of time, 2008 to 2020. But then they said, here were the numbers, okay? The prevalence of perinatal PTSD increased dramatically over the course of the study. So like, okay, right on. I get that. I'm with it. And then they go on to say the cohort included 0.4% perinatal PTSD in 2008, and it was 1.9% perinatal PTSD in 2020. Okay. So yeah, that is close to a 400% increase. but at their max, it was 1.9%. Now, most people, like the next publication that we're about to review, which is from the Gray Journal, that came out at the end of December 2023, said that even though numbers are all over the place on this, in general, you can say that true perinatal PTSD, not just traumatic events, because traumatic events could be, it depends on who you read, anywhere from 30 to 40% of all deliveries. Something traumatic happened, and that could be just pain, pain out of control. That's why when a patient says, oh my gosh, I'm hurting so bad, get on top of that. I mean, get that woman some pain medication, whatever she's desiring, or use a non-pharmacological method to relieve pain, because that could be a trauma trigger, okay? So just because there's a trauma trigger doesn't mean you can have PTSD, right? So if 30 to 40% have some kind of trauma trigger, out of those, 5 to 6% can develop perinatal PTSD. So most OBGYN data say that perinatal PTSD in the general population, which is not just insured population, see, that's one of the disconnects from this data mining, is about 4 to 6%. So one of the rebuttals for it, wait a minute, are you saying it's 1.9% and that's a 400% increase? Dude, it's like 4 to 6% based on the majority of OBGYN data. So this is totally underestimating, because likely it's only on the codes that were put in. And again, it only looked at commercially insured patients. But again, I'll take this as a win, because it does call attention to perinatal PTSD. That article that came out at the end of December 2023 from the Gray Journal, the first listed author is Deckel. Deckel has done a lot of research on this, and it's an incredible review. It's a systematic review and meta-analysis on how to best prevent PTSD following childbirth. And I really liked this publication. I wanted to highlight this when it first came out. And again, of course, I got sidetracked. But these were authors out of Mass General. And we're going to cover that next. Why don't we let that settle, take a couple of seconds, and we'll cover this publication from the end of December 2023, coming up next. Thank you for being part of our podcast family. We really are grateful and thankful that you've chosen to take this journey of medical education with us. You're listening to Clinical Pearls. Everyone, before we get into ACOG's committee opinion number 825 from 2021 and the Gray Journal's publication, not just from December 2023, but the one from last month, which is March 2024, I do want to say this right off the bat, and I know I said it in the intro. The discussion, the email excerpt that I read from that listener in Ireland, I did so with complete written permission. This listener said, hey, you can use my story if you want to for education, so that others learn from it. So I adhere to that. I'm doing this as a way to honor her event and also just to bring attention to this, because, again, this is in our print. Not only did that come out April the 1st, that weird data mining study, but I'm going to show you two very relevant publications from December 2023 and then one at the end of March 2024 that drive this home, so we can all be aware of this. Please talk about this amongst yourselves, with your partners, about how to address this, or make sure that you call a caseworker / social worker, whatever your hospital has, so that when something objectively traumatic or potentially subjectively traumatic happens, this is not left out there in the wind. Okay, now that we've stated that, ACOG does have Committee Opinion 821 from April 2021 that is caring for patients who have experienced trauma. And this is a great reminder that even if something doesn't go south with a delivery, just the fact of having legs in lithotomy, you know, pushing, being exposed for somebody who's had, let's say, sexual abuse, that could be traumatic. So this is why ACOG put this together for trauma-informed care, and there's been several commentaries on that, of course, but caring for patients who have experienced trauma is a big deal. We're also going to talk about briefly the four R's that everybody should have. We should, if you're in a medical, if you're in medical education, if you have residents or medical students, everybody should be taught, of course, the four R's, right? We do the CAGE questionnaire for like addictions. We've got the PHQ-9 for depression. We have all these acronyms out there, and those are all necessary. We need to have that. And the four R's is on that. So always be aware that people bring with them their past. So even though things seem to be going fine, if they had a traumatic last delivery, if they had a traumatic issue in childhood, that may be triggered, of course, with childbirth processes. What we do is very intimate, obviously. And so that's why I always ask, hey, we're about to do a vaginal exam. I do need to put your feet up in these footrests. Remember, they're not stirrups, they're footrests. Is that okay? You know, how do you feel about that? It's going to be very brief. I'll leave you as covered up as possible, but we just have to have good exposure to make sure that you're healthy enough for delivery or whatever. Does that make sense? So always be aware. You never know where a patient has come from. Anyway, I wanted to give everybody that reminder of committee opinion number 821. And now let's briefly talk about the four R's before we talk about the two Gray Journal articles. Oh, dang, nah, but hold on. I almost forgot a separate ACOG publication, which is committee opinion 736. That's on optimizing postpartum care, right? The name has nothing to do with trauma. However, one of the ways to optimize postpartum care is to realize that postpartum traumatic events may have happened. So you have to be able to realize this and ask about this, because in this committee opinion, which goes all the way back to 2018, ACOG reminds us, and look how these numbers are different than that data mining set. According to the college, quote, a traumatic birth experience can cause postpartum post-traumatic stress disorder, which affects, y'all ready, 3 to 16% of women, end quote. Now, that's higher than what was referenced in the December 2023 Gray Journal, and then again, March 2024 in the separate Gray Journal publication that typically puts it around anywhere from 3% to 4% up to 6%. So in 2018, they're like, hey, it could be as high as 16%. And the reason that those numbers vary, again, is based on how you're defining not only a traumatic event, but the occurrence of PTSD, as we've already discussed. And I love this quote from the college from 2018. Guys, I'm going to get to the two Gray Journals very quickly and the thing about the dogs, because that's fascinating. And then we're going to start wrapping this up. But let me read you this quote. Trauma is in the eye of the beholder. And healthcare providers should be aware that a woman may experience a birth traumatic event even if she and her infant are healthy. Wow, I got to do that again. Trauma is in the eye of the beholder. And healthcare providers should be aware that a woman may experience a birth as traumatic even if she and her infant are healthy. Man, that's good. All right, that finally brings us to the systematic review and meta-analysis from the Gray Journal from December 17th, 2023. The title, once again, is Preventing Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Following Childbirth, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This was done from researchers from Mass General out of Boston.
Did I win?
Your cousin.
From Boston.
Oh, sorry, I just couldn't help myself. It's been such a deep, kind of heavy topic, and we had to do something to lighten load a little bit. And for those of you that are outside of the U.S. who had no idea what that just was, it's a commercial for beer. Yeah, for Boston Lager. And since these researchers were from Mass General in Boston, I couldn't help myself. All right, back on to business. Researchers from Mass General looked at 41 clinical trials to look for interventions that could help prevent PTSD. Okay, here it is, guys, because we're running out of time very quickly. This systematic review and meta-analysis by Deckel and her team, again, based on that 41 clinical trial systematic review and meta-analysis, found that interventions seem to be the most effective, quote, when administered in the first days after childbirth rather than later, end quote. Let's just stop there. I mean, isn't that enough? I mean, right there, just talk about it. And you're like, well, what does that mean? Like, do I need to take an hour? No. A brief discussion, brief intervention, as the authors state, quote, conventional trauma-focused therapies, which directly focus on processing the traumatic birth event and midwife-led dialogue-based counseling at the bedside, were the most promising interventions. It doesn't have to be fancy. Just talking about it and saying, how does that make you feel? You don't want to talk about it. Do you understand? And being open with it, best intervention. They also looked at things like mindfulness, which has a place, mother-infant focused interventions, it has a place, computer gaming, again, try to reprogram some of those circuits, has a place, but they stated, yeah, it's good, but it really needs a further investigation. There's nothing like addressing it when it's fresh to prevent it from simmering. That's really the take home there. Again, systematic review, meta-analysis, and what we get is, hey, talk about it. Talk about it early. Is that crazy or what? That's exactly from the Mr. Rogers quote. You see how we brought that back? Amazing. And they said, yes, things that help is like, you know, writing things down, writing down in a journal, writing it as a note, whatever. All that also is helpful. And here's what's surprising. Quote, educational material alone did not seem to help in the event of a traumatic birth. Okay, so like, hey, read this pamphlet about subgaleal hemorrhage, or read this pamphlet about whatever, fourth degree lax. Those are good for education, but don't let that, to take home messages that has a role, do that, give them that info, but don't think that's a surrogate that's going to take the place of detailed information and counseling. Oh my goodness, this is getting really lengthy. Let me cover the second publication from March 2024 under Expert Reviews, again from the Gray Journal. The title is Childbirth-Related Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Definition, Risk Factors, Pathophysiology, Diagnosis, Prevention, and Treatment. See how it's very similar to same journal, guys, just 3 months prior. Do you see that? Why do we have so much information coming from this? They're like, oh, isn't this a duplicate? No. It's a different angle, different spin on the same issue because it's real. It's legit. And this is how people get tocophobia. Remember our previous episode on fear of childbirth, tocophobia. So when you see a patient come into clinic and her blood pressure is high, she's like super anxious, like, hey, you just got here. What's going on? Like, no one's touched you. No one said anything to you. That's a flag. See, that's part of one of the R's of the four R's. You thought I forgot about that, right? I did not. But I wanted to wait until we get to this part because this publication, where Horsch is the first listed author, goes over the four R's. So for sake of time, I wanted to highlight those two Gray Journal publications, December 2023 and then March 2024, just last month. And I want to just briefly focus on what the four R's are for trauma-informed care. Okay, it's very easy. And this is not just for OBGYN. This can be applied across disciplines, recognizing that people bring with them past traumas, past hurts, past hangups to their care. The four R's, very easy. Number one is realize that trauma happens and exists and it's widespread, right? So it could be childbirth trauma, childhood trauma, spouse trauma. So just realize people have stuff. People have gone through stuff. That's number one, realization that this is real. Number two, recognition of unresolved trauma. Just like the example that we stated, a patient walks in, she starts getting anxious. You're like, whoa, what is happening here? Now, she could just hate healthcare providers. That's possible because people have white coat fear. But where does that come from? That very well could be a manifestation, a flag of pre-existing trauma. So number one, the first R is realization that it's out there. Two, recognize flags. Number three, have a way to respond to that. That's response by incorporating knowledge into practice. In other words, asking, hey, what's going on? Did something happen? I understand you're really anxious. So do something about it. Not like, it's not my problem. Don't do that. Respond is the right thing to do. And then four, resist re-traumatization. Okay? Like, it's just a speculum. You know, why do you have to have so much discomfort with it? Just a speculum. That would not be good, right? So the four R's are realize that it's real, recognize flags, three, have a way to respond, four, resist re-traumatization. Those are the four R's. Okay, everyone, as we get ready to wrap this up, just something on a more lighter note, I guess, but still super impactful, talking about dogs, okay? No, I haven't totally lost my mind. This is totally related, okay? We all know that seizure response dogs, and that's really what they are. They're seizure response. They're not seizure alert because you can't train a dog to detect a seizure. However, even though you can't train a dog to detect seizure, if they know their owner well, okay, they spend enough time with them, they can pick up on small cues and alert as a secondary benefit if a seizure is happening. We don't know how it happens. There's plenty of theories that perhaps we're picking up some small volatile odors that the body gives off as a stress response before a seizure happens. That's actually been checked, and there's pretty good data that that's a thing. They're picking up small cues in the actual behavior of the owner, and then it causes them to act a certain way. Dogs usually will circle the owner paw at them or stare at them right in their face. That's another interesting one. They like stare at them like, well, are you about to go down? What's happening? So even though it's not a trained issue, they're trained to respond to a seizure, like lick the face to help bring them back, or press a button that, like a medical alert to call EMS or family members. They can even be trained to get medication. So they can be trained to respond, but they're not really alert to dogs. They do that secondarily, okay? But this whole issue of volatile odors, are they giving off some kind of chemical pre-seizure that dogs are picking up on? That is now being looked at. And there's actually a pilot study that was just published on March the 28th, 2024, testing to see if dogs can detect a scent in the breath of patients with PTSD. And the short of it is, it was very promising. So the idea is that if you have PTSD and your cortisol level is high, somehow your biochemistry is off. Guys, is this wild or what? I know it sounds like you're putting me on, man. No. It had like 90% accuracy across all samples for them to detect the signals based on breath samples, right? So control people, hey, I'm otherwise good. I don't think I have PTSD. You know, I don't have any real concerns. That's the control. And then those with suspected PTSD and are confirmed, looking for VOCs, volatile organic compounds. And they had 90% accuracy. I just thought that was interesting. I don't want to get into that too much. But as a way that they are seizure response dogs, maybe this is a way to not just use dogs to reduce PTSD, because we know that they do. We know that dogs reduce hypertension. We know that dogs reduce depression. I'm very thankful for our little weenie dog, Pretzel, who gives me unconditional love. And that there's something to that. It's one of the great cures for loneliness. Notice I said one, because it's not the cure for loneliness. The cure for loneliness is get out and talk to people and have a good social support network. Yes, this is actually a thing. It was published, out of all things, in Frontiers in Allergy, because I guess the volatile substances, you know, coming out through the mouth. It's kind of weird why it was published in Allergy, but it was. And the title was, Can Scent Detection Dogs Detect the Stress Associated with Trauma in Cues from People with Trauma Histories? A Proof of Concept Study. Super interesting. And of course, I'll post this link on our reference list. All right. I hope this brought attention to PTSD in the perinatal interval and given it the attention that it deserves, because it is real. And remember, the best way to prevent its occurrence is by dealing with it early on, ideally within that initial hospitalization. All right, let's bring it home. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. As always, we're thankful for you, and we're glad you're part of our podcast community. We'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.